Up next, an interview with legendary NASA flight director Gene Kranz.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
If the truth were known, we really delayed this launch so we could get the burritos on time.
I figured that.
The flight director says get back in.
We lost the flight plan out the window.
On all three networks, you replaced all the kitty cartoons.
Houston, we've had a problem.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
I was rolling on the moon one day.
Counter, go and throttle up.
Go and throttle up.
The Earth from here is a grand oasis.
You're listening to The Space Program, NASA's past, present, and future.
An interview with legendary flight director from NASA, Gene Kranz. This is Rich Kirshner reporting. Eugene Kranz was born in Toledo, Ohio on August 17th of 1933. After entering the Air Force and serving in South Korea, Kranz began work for McDonnell Aircraft testing missile launches off of B-52s at Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico. When the Manned Spacecraft Center opened in Houston, Kranz became Chief of Flight Control Operations. He served as Gemini Flight Director from 1964 until 1968. Between 1969 and 1973, his other duties at the Manned Spacecraft Control Center included Chief of the Flight Control Division, Flight Director for Apollo and Skylab programs, Flight Director for the first lunar landing of Apollo 11, and Lead Flight Director of Apollo 13. He also served as the Flight Operations Director during the Skylab program from 1969 to 1974. At the end of Skylab in 1974, Kranz was promoted to Deputy Director of Flight Operations and then in 1983 to Director of Mission Operations. He retired from NASA in 1994. Gene Kranz now joins us for a very special interview. Gene, how were you selected to be a flight director, and what qualifications was NASA looking for?
It was, you got to go back into the late 50s, early 60s. And as part of the pilot, when I came back from Korea, I was assigned to flight tankers, and I wasn't interested in doing that. So I went to reserve status, and I'd been flying fighters prior to that time, the F-86 and the F-100. So I went to reserve status, and I was looking to be a backseater in the 101 auto attack program. And went to McDonald's, signed up, was all set to do that, but all the slots for that were filled, so they sent me out to Holloman Air Force Base as a flight test engineer in the B-52. Now, this was a strange arrangement because the McDonald was basically leasing the Bombay. Intelligence community determined that the Soviet Union more than likely had surface-to-air missile capabilities, so it was a question of how is the B-52 going to penetrate Soviet airspace. And this centered around decoy missiles. This turned out various radar echo simulators and chaff and all that kind of crap.
Mm-hmm.
So we tested and developed and were very successful in developing what they call the GAM-72, which is a air-launched missile that basically had all of the properties of a B-52. It could also change altitude, airspeed. It could sprint, do all kinds of things. And we could load four of those guys in the F-Bombay. It was a very interesting and great program. And in addition, since this was they're flying in the Bombay, we'd put various shapes in there. We'd do tuft studies around there. We'd look at airflow and separation studies. So it was really a great program. When it finished, it was 2 years long. When it finished, I was looking around to where do I go next. I had a chance to go out to Edwards with the F-4. General Dynamics wanted me to get into the missile business. But I saw an advertisement in Aviation Week magazine that said they were forming a space task group, and they're looking for qualified engineers to determine the feasibility of putting an American in space. I filled out the government application in there and waited about 6 to 8 weeks, didn't hear anything, and I thought they're passing me by. And I got a phone call from Langley Field, which is where the headquarters Space Task Group was, and they asked if I was interested. Basically, I said yes. They said, well, when can you report in? And I gave them about a month to finish up what I had at Holloman and go take some time off. So I reported to Langley Research Center Space Task Group in October 1960. Basically, what happened, the engineers coming in at that time, they were just forming up. So I went into a pool with other engineers, and periodically someone would come in over the first couple weeks and say, hey, I need somebody for recovery in your end, I need somebody for trajectory design, or somebody down for launch operations at the Cape. And I thought I was the odd man out, and then about 2 weeks after I'd been there, a guy comes in, he's Chris Kraft, and he introduces himself very tersely and says, I want you to go to the Cape, I want you to write a countdown, write some mission rules, and when you're through, give me a call and we'll come down and launch. So that was my introduction to the space program. 2 weeks in the job, I was sent to the Cape, and I wrote the countdown for the first Mercury Redstone 1 launch and the related mission rules. Yeah, I was never interviewed, by the fact. I mean, it was all pure paper.
So Chris Kraft took you under his wing immediately.
Yes, he did, and it turned out to be a fortuitous marriage because he was learning the job, and I knew a lot about the job. The principal thing about Mercury control was we didn't have satellites or any of that kind of stuff, so basically we operated 13 tracking stations around the world, many of which you couldn't communicate to directly, so low-speed teletype that dated back to the days of the Pony Express was our principal form of communications. And basically across the continental United States to Bermuda, we could communicate directly, and the same thing out to Hawaii. But from then on, it was basically teletype. And so basically, I had worked in that kind of an environment. Morse code was our backup form of communications. If we lost normal comm, UHF comm with the crew, so I knew Morse code. So I had a good background in the flight test experiments out at Holloman. I had a team of around 21 people I had to pull together daily and get to sign off on the flight. So I had the kind of experience that fit mission control very, very well. So it was to the point where I could figure out what Chris needed and get it done before he knew he needed it. And he was a great, great, great leader, gave me every opportunity in the world. So by the time I got to John Glenn's mission, he had named me as the assistant flight director. And basically I continued doing what I was doing, but basically I was learning more about the business now of time critical, irrevocable, high risk management, and making the decisions related to it. So that was my introduction to the Mercury program.
Expanding just a little bit on the communication aspect, how did you communicate by voice with Guaymas, Australia, and other parts of the world that were on the far side? We didn't have satellites at the time that would do all that stuff.
Many of them, you know, if you really think about it, you got to go back to the technology at that time. They had the Atlantic cable that went from out of New York through Bermuda to London. So that got us cable communications as far as London. Then we'd go high-frequency point-to-point into Kano, Nigeria, into Zanzibar. Well, we did the same thing with Australia. We'd go through Hawaii, and basically we'd get over in Japan. And then we'd go HF point-to-point for all the sites that were in the Pacific Ocean area. And the same thing for our ships. We had two ships, Costa Century Quebec and Rosnaut Vector. So it was basically potluck any one day. If I don't know if your listeners there are familiar with how communications was done, you had these huge patch boards. And the majority of the patch board, you'd make cable connections from the Cape to I want to talk to Bermuda, I want to talk to Australia. He'd actually take and connect a cable between where the Cape voice coming in and basically where we wanted to send it. So this was the technology that was going at that time, and I'd say at any one time we could probably rely on about 50% communications capabilities once we left Atlantic Cable, Canary Islands was on it, and once we left the Pacific Cable.
So
it was pretty dicey.
So that was pretty much like on the TV shows Hee Haw or Andy Griffith, that the operator would push a quarter-inch plug into a socket and somebody would have a telephone connection.
Yep, that's exactly the way, that's exactly a good summary.
Wow.
Only the problem was, I was up at Goddard and watched these guys, and he had a whole bunch of color-coded cables that he'd actually hang around his neck. Okay, and he'd run between this huge patchboard, which was basically about 16 foot long and about 6 feet high. And basically, we not only communicated our tracking station, we also communicated to the eastern tracking range. So basically, we went down along the launch corridor that the Air Force was using at that time.
And I'm sure that you wore out the Navy as far as their recovery operations as well.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Space Program.
We're speaking with retired flight director Gene Kranz from NASA. Gene, did your flight team get selected for you, or were you able to select them yourself, figure out their strengths?
Basically, the first three flight directors were Chris Kraft, John Hodge, an Englishman, and myself. We selected the colors red, white, and blue. And in the early Gemini program, everybody had some kind of a other duty as assigned kind of thing. Chris was the division chief. John Hodge was the branch chief. I had the section, and I became branch chief, deputy branch chief. So we had other jobs to do to prepare for the mission. Get the control teams ready to deploy, write the mission rules, get the flight planning done, get the procedures done, debrief the previous mission, what are you going to do differently in this one? So we would establish a routine where each one of us would become what was called a lead flight director. And the lead would basically take the overall, he'd handle the interface with the program office and with the astronauts, with the media. And basically, he would basically supervise the pulling together of everything we needed for a mission. I was the lead for Gemini 9. So basically, I had that kind of responsibility. So each one of us assumed a lead role, not only to get the flying part done, but to get all the pre-mission stuff done. We generally start about a year before a mission, the lead would, and he'd pull the package together with the objectives, the overall top level of the flight plan. He developed the overall mission rules and philosophy. Mission rules basically are the risk versus risk decisions we make during the mission. So we'd get those pretty well squared away, and then we'd come in the final 3 months to learn what the mission was about. Then we'd fly the mission and then debrief, and then the next lead would pick up running the show. So that was a good opportunity to grow, and in particular, on the Gemini 4 mission, it was the first mission I was going to be a flight director on, because Kraft flew 3, which was a 3-orbit mission, relatively short. 4 was longer. I got called into Kraft's office one day, and basically Kraft said, I hope you're ready for your flight director jobs, because I got something else I want you to do. And basically what he wanted me to do was to plan the Ed White EVA. Because we were pressing very hard to set our own space records in extravehicular operations. So basically what I would do is I'd do a normal day's work, close up about 4 o'clock, 4:30, go home, eat, and then come back about 6:30. And I had a small team, a secretary, and one other controller. Everything was top secret. We called it Plan X. And we'd go over to the Crew Systems Division, get together with Ed White and the people from Crew Systems who are developing all the suits and all that kind of stuff. And basically, we worked for the best part of about 4 months to pull together a plan, and then are waiting for White House approval. The only problem is the Soviets beat us to the game with the manned first EVA, but basically, our EVA was much longer. So overall, I think we won the game and the most effective EVA. The other thing that was interesting about this, we kept it secret until the White House said go. And we deployed the people to all of our tracking stations with a doubly sealed envelope, and on the envelope was Plan X. And it was only when they got the go-ahead, we had finished the tracking, they deployed all the sites, we got the go-ahead, and this was about 5 days prior to launch. We told them to open up Plan X, and this is the first time where all the people at the tracking stations and the flight surgeons and everybody else find out we were going to do an EVA.
Well, that was rather aggressive for just a second Gemini mission. Now, you knocked down one of my questions before I could ask it. As far as developing a flight plan, could you perhaps expand on that a little bit?
The flight plan process, it actually started off probably about 18 to 24 months, where the program office would give us a set of objectives for each mission. The crew would be named, a spacecraft capsule and a booster would be assigned, and a launch date was given. So basically, we took that package then and had to flush it out with, okay, how are we going to get to this objective? We were very objective-oriented because each one of the missions really set the stage for the subsequent mission, all the way through not only Gemini, but all the way through Apollo program. So it was really a question of, I won't say hate to say, but basically sometimes I'd find myself flying a mission and working in the planning for the subsequent mission. And we were running basically a production line for missions, because during Gemini and during Apollo, once we start off with first manned mission, we'd fly roughly about every 2 months.
It did go pretty aggressively at that point. I do remember that.
Yeah.
Boy, there's a lot of different things that we could discuss at that point, but computers of the day were somewhat primitive by today's standards. I can imagine many of the controllers using slide rules or longhand math.
Well, we did that. It's interesting, during Mercury, we had three main frames supporting all of Project Mercury. Two of these main frames IBM put up at Goddard Space Flight Center. They were the first fully transistorized computers they had developed. And IBM did not trust us to operate. And we were certainly capable of operating the first transistorized machines. In the island of Bermuda, we put a hybrid, which is part digital and part analog, out there. And again, we had a small team of controllers at that site. So the controllers were basically, the computers allowed us to track what was happening during a mission from a standpoint of trajectory, and that was about it. In Mercury, we'd get the crewmen up there. They had no computer on board the spacecraft. And we'd get the ground tracking in there, and we'd, after about two or three stations, we'd tell the crew they were go for one orbit, or go for two orbits, or go for three orbits. And that was it was very rudimentary, but in our business, risk was the price of progress, and we just stepped up to those risks and made things happen.
The movie Hidden Figures involved women that actually were called computers. They were doing calculations and such. What was your contact with them, or what do you know about them? How could you perhaps validate that story?
Well, interestingly enough, by the time we got into Gemini, I was branch chief now. So I had a lot of lateral communications with the people who were doing the trajectory design. And Johnny Mayer was the boss of the flight design organization. He had about 100 women. They were all mathematicians. And basically, they would deploy a small group, 3 to 5, down to the Cape with us for each one of our launch to drop the plot boards. And basically, once we got more data in the booster and the performance and propellant loaded and all that kind of stuff, they could update the trajectory plans that we had. So basically, it was a very tight loop between ourselves and the flight design organization. What was really the key was in Gemini, they put a 4,000-word computer on board the spacecraft. And everyone who had flown Mercury, very few people in Mercury had ever had any experience with a computer. I had one, and the F-100 had one, but it was basically a relatively simple autopilot. But we were fortunate at that time, and I'd back to 1958, when the Soviets launched Sputnik. Johnson, yeah, he recognized that the United States, if they were going to compete with Soviets in space, they had to develop the skills, the engineering skills and the technology skills. So I got together with, I think it was Jimmy Doolittle, and the two sat down and wrote out a requirement for a national student defense loan program, which is based along the lines of the GI Bill, that would allow kids to go to college on a loan program, and basically that way we could start building the skills that we needed. Well, if you do that, that started in 1958. Around 1962, we were getting ready for the Gemini program, and that's when we took these young pucks in out of college, and basically they became very important to us. The also thing that happened, a lot of the Army was working with computers in the ground air missile program and in the Nikes, and basically we got several people that were non-coms out there that basically wanted to get into NASA, so we had sort of a hybrid organization down there, composed of young kids from college and former military personnel had come in and had experience with computers, with their working at their whatever base they were on. So it was real interesting to come to grasp with that. We had it all, so we had to learn about the cryogenics and fuel cells and bipropellant rocket engines, inertial systems and all that. So Gemini was the breakthrough.
It seemed like it was not just a scientific development and exploration and so forth, but also matters of national security.
Yeah, there was a large amount of that, but basically everything that we did was branded confidential. The technologies, our handbooks, the crew debriefings, and we carried that all the way through the Apollo program. And it was interesting because the controllers, I had hundreds of controllers. By the time we got to Apollo, I was division chief. I had about 350 people that had to know what went on in the previous mission. So it was always a hassle to get all the clearances and all the paperwork so we could handle that material.
You're listening to The Space Program.
We're speaking with retired NASA flight director Gene Kranz. Gene, I've got two more for you and then two fun ones.
Okay.
With the exception of Apollo 13, what was the most challenging event you had ever had to deal with as a flight director in mission control?
And we're coming up on the 50th anniversary. That was Apollo 11. All the people that you see the movies, they got this new one coming out, First Man, etc., really doesn't talk about what happened during the descent to the lunar surface. And they don't talk about how close we were to losing that, basically having to abort the mission. They only talk about the last 3 minutes when the crew's down towards the surface, but the time that we got started coming downhill to go into the moon, we had major communications problems. We couldn't communicate with the crew. They couldn't communicate with us. I made the decision to commit to the descent, betting in the come line that we'd solve the communications problem in the first 5 minutes, and if not, then we'd have to abort. And basically, we were working that, and with the intermediate trajectory data we got from the spacecraft, one of my controllers basically identified that we had some kind of an aberration in the trajectory. We're going to land long, and basically due to the radial component velocity, when he was looking at the inertial components of the maneuver that had been performed where we were right now, he said we're halfway to our abort limit. Abort is not a term you lose casually in mission control. Well, we were starting to work that, but again, we didn't have the continuous data we needed for about the first 3 to 4 minutes, and we'd relay instructions from mission control to Mike Collins in the command module. He'd then pass it on to the crew. But I continued to press. We got enough data, so I felt confident in continuing on. And about the time now we're getting ready to get landing radar, because the crew started their descent based on altitude information that we had given them from the ground. But now we needed absolute measurements from the lunar module to the lunar surface. So we're waiting for that landing radar to come in when we start getting a series of computer program alarms. Well, the thing that was interesting, and I'm doing a speech up at the Smithsonian in November, did some research there that normally the software that we had on board the lunar module was using basically about almost 70% central processing unit time just through the descent. So anything that was abnormal raised that, and we had basically a series of messages coming in from the rendezvous radar that said, hey, you're not sending me any data, which increased it now up to about 83% CPU. And then Buzz Aldrin was asking for some data out of the computers, what the altitude was. Key thing is, and several times we basically faulted down in the computer to only addressing the guidance and navigation problems. And if those guys went south on us, we were going to abort. So basically, all through the landing, we're now trying to solve the problems working around program alarms we got. And normally around 15,000 feet, Neil Armstrong should be looking at his landing site so he gets some idea how he's going to maneuver to get into place. Well, by now we knew we were going to be landing long. We're going to be landing in a boulder field. But he can't look down there now. He has to keep addressing and keep trying to fly the spacecraft because it was on the ragged margin of not being able to fly. So we had that going on down there. And then we finally get the information from the ground. We get the radar updated. The computer program alarms slack off a bit. Communications are better. But now we're getting down towards the surface. And we come across, we get the glow level indication from the spacecraft. Normally, we landed on the moon on training at low level. But at low level, it's sort of like driving your car in empty. Once that is triggered in mission control, we have 120 seconds of fuel at a 30% throttle setting. So now we have Diana's stopwatch counting down seconds of fuel remaining as the crew's trying to come down to the surface. The time he finally landed, he had to overfly a very large crater down there. As he's getting down, if you're a pilot landing an airplane or you've ever driven in snow where the snow is blowing along the road ahead of you, you get a very funny sensation in there that you're not moving. The snow's moving at the same speed you are. And that was what Neil Armstrong was experiencing. And finally, we're now telling him he's got 60 seconds of fuel remaining and then 30 seconds of fuel remaining. And then about the time that we said 15, we recognized the crew had just landed the moon and shut down. So that's about as close as you ever want to get the first time you try to land on the moon.
And that was a 1201 alarm.
Yeah.
To expand just very slightly, you're mentioning the boulders. Was that a pre-flight imaging thing that you knew about, or did that just up because you were saying that Neil was not looking out the window, he was looking at the instruments?
See, we had picked out the landing ellipse we had where we figured we could land is essentially about, 7 miles long and about 2 miles wide. And we thought that he could find a place to land, but if he landed right in the middle, it was very smooth. What happened due to this trajectory problem we had earlier, he's going to be landing long. Now, if he didn't have these computer program alarms, he could have recognized this, where he was going to land. And what happened, the computer would tell them that he has what they call a landing point designator. It's scribe lines in the windshield that the computer will say, if you look out the window at this scribe line number 6 or whatever it was, you'll see the landing point out there. So then the crew can maneuver to a more suitable landing point. But Neil Armstrong didn't have the option to do that because he was busy just trying to fly the airplane.
Now, he was in direct control as opposed to Buzz. He actually had the controls, right?
Basically, it was automatic throughout most of the descent because it was impossible for any person to efficiently fly because we were very propellant limited. Getting down to the surface of the moon. And it was the computer basically was doing all the flying except for one period up and away where Neil took over and checked out just all the hand controller and all the systems are going to work and then handed it back to automatic. And then once he got down close to the surface of the ground, probably about 800 to 1,000 feet, that's when he picked up. And now manually had to fly to a landing site.
And that was... very historic. I mean, history could have been totally changed had everything not fallen, the cards falling into the right spot.
You're exactly right.
You're listening to The Space Program.
Again, speaking with retired NASA flight director Gene Kranz regarding Apollo 13, the movie, did you have any contact with the producers, director Ron Howard, or Ed Harris, who actually portrayed you in the movie? Did they consult you to make sure that everything was actually accurate?
No, actually, it was quite a bit different from that. One of my controller's son went through the University of Houston and basically got into the various arts and crafts and all, so he went out to Hollywood, and his father thought he'd never make any money out there. But he signed on with an outfit called Imagine Entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
They turned out to be able to acquire so many good properties, it's incredible. But anyway, he knew that Lovell was writing a book. Lovell had finished basically one chapter. So he went to the bosses and said, hey, we ought to get the movie rights for the book. We ought to get the control of the book. So this is more an internal thing among the controllers and Jim and Fredo and all that. So he did. But the problem was they didn't have enough money to produce the movie, though. So they had to go to a studio. And the studio sent their financial people down here to talk about it, because space movies at the time they did 95, if I remember right, they don't make much money. So they came down, we talked about it. About a month later, they came down again, only this time they came down with people, and I came in with several of my controllers, so we talked. They finally decided they're going to do it. So then they pick up Ron Howard as the producer of this thing here, so we have another time. This is sit down now in Mission Control with Ron, and some of the script writers and my controllers are doing their thing. We're talking about it. So eventually we ended up working over the script. We looked at the script as best they would let us make changes, and they're pretty good about that. Ron Howard was an absolute bear to make sure that at least technically it was correct, at least from a spacecraft and crew standpoint. And then they came down with all of the various actors and actresses that had been selected for this. And they went down to Petey's Bar, which was a bar right across from Ellington Air Force Base. And they rehearsed their parts all night. They'd do their parts. And I never knew. I thought when they were doing a part, they were talking to a real person. But no, in their mind, they're talking to a real person. So it was really interesting going through that. Strange thing was, Ed Harris was not there.
Oh.
He was doing a movie at that time. But he got a hold of some raw movie material I'd done. I'd finished and done the PBS special called To the Edge and Back. So he got a hold of that. That was, to a great extent, that was done in collaboration also with Japanese TV Asahi. And at the end of that thing, they made the Japanese, and this was probably the most intense interview I'd ever had. Lasted the best part of 2 days. I sort of cracked up. And Ed Harris saw that, said, hey, I don't know, I need to know about Kranz. What I got to do is I got to find out about how he operates. So when it came time to shoot the movie, he hired two of my controllers, Jerry Griffin, who is one of my flight directors, and Jerry Bostick, who was my trajectory guy. Mm. That's what happened in the movie.
That's very interesting. It's not common knowledge as far as the average person would know. Gene, I got one more for you, and then two fun ones.
Okay.
How much one-on-one training did you perform with astronaut crews before a mission? As in speaking with the astronauts or having their input or they're giving you their beefs or what they can't do or they don't think they can, what you tell them they have to be able to do, how'd that work out?
Yeah, that's a good question. Basically, we'd have an average, I'd say, about five very intense meetings with the crew. The first one would be to look at the objectives and lay out the sort of sketch out a flight plan. And that would generally be about half a day, maybe a full day. And from then on, the astronauts would designate a communicator that would be working in mission control. He'd be working the flight plan components with us from then on. The tough part came during the mission rules, and the mission rules are pre-planned statements on how we're going to make the risk versus risk and risk versus gain trade-offs. And this gets very emotional. The mission rules document for Apollo 11 was 360 pages of policy. This is how each controller is going to respond based on this kind of a problem. Just for the landing itself, I had 17 pages, most of which is related to trajectory. So basically, these are the areas where we debate with the crew. How long are we going to go? For instance, if my communications problem had not been sorted, I would give the go to start the descent to just buy 5 more minutes to keep troubleshooting the communications problem before I would abort. That was one of the rules I had in there. Another rule said once the crew takes over control of the spacecraft, there are no guidance and control rules because what's happening is the crew is flying it right now. And all of these neat algorithms, the smart things we have in the computer don't matter a whit. So the policy part is the thing that is most difficult to get an agreement between the controllers of the flight director and the flight director's team to the crews. And that is about one-third. If you take, say you got 6 months to prepare for a mission, almost 2 of those months are debated with addressing the mission rules and the policy related to the rules and then testing them in the simulations and that kind of stuff. That's where the majority of the workload goes that is very controversial. And then later on, we get into a lot of the details, and we spend roughly about 30 to 35 days in joint simulations with the crew where they're in the simulator. I'm in mission control with my teams, and I have another team of controllers who basically are developing training exercises to see how we react to certain cases, how well the flight plan worked out, were the mission rules written properly, et cetera. That's we spent a lot of time.
Sounds like you're you actually have a marriage, so to speak, or by these days standards or speech, you're having to be in sync to be able to work with each other, know each other's thoughts, and be able to work with each other immediately.
Well, it's interesting going back to Apollo 13. A lot of times I was ever worried that we wouldn't be able to bring this home, and I'd say no. And I'd say, well, how can you be so positive? And I say, you know, I got an astronaut in the spacecraft. Eli, he wants to know how I'm thinking. Then does Kranz have any doubts? If he has doubts, maybe I'm going to have doubts. So you have to have that kind of a trusting relationship. Otherwise, it won't work.
Let me ask you a very quick one on 13 again. Who was in charge, you or Chris Kraft? I mean, who had the most say? Legend has it was you. Did Chris Kraft have, I'm sure he had input, did he also have override on you as far as decisions?
I'll read you from, believe it or not, it's interesting. This is a letter from the White House. It says, the president was briefed on the Apollo 13. The decision commented that during such critical situations, decisions are not made by committees, but rather by individuals. He was told that in the case of the Apollo 13 emergency last night, it was the flight director who rendered the important decisions. The flight director is the ultimate authority. If you take a look at whatever happened in mission control, there is no case where the flight director was ever overridden in any decision he made.
That's very interesting. That's cool information, Gene. That really is.
Yeah, he's at the flight director's job description is one sentence long. The flight director may take any actions necessary for crew safety and mission success.
Well, it's like a commander.
You mentioned Chris Kraft, which is very interesting. Chris Kraft is what we call the flight operations director. And he is the blocking back for the team. He keeps the outside world off the back of the control team.
So he's like the Enterprise raising her shields.
Yep.
Okay. I'm going to be talking to Walter Cunningham from Apollo 7. Do you have a sneaky, fun story about him or not? If not, you can forego that question.
Now, we don't ever booby-trap our guys that way.
Oh, come on.
you know, Walt's a very interesting guy. And we're getting ready to celebrate the Apollo 7. If I looked at my calendar, if I had it up right now, Apollo 7 anniversary. We're going to have anniversaries from here on up. But Walt is, if I remember, the honorary dinner chair for an outfit I'm going to be talking to 23rd of this month. And it's the fundraiser for the restoration of mission control.
The original flight control room?
Pardon? Yeah, we're putting it back in the exact configuration it was, complete with cigarettes, ashtrays, all the kind of crap, sticky waste baskets filled with empty pizza boxes, you name it.
You know,
that's the way it's going to look.
I got a tour back in 2006, I believe it was. There was only two, what do they call them, those nameplates. One was Capcom and one was Flight Director. All the rest were gone. I was disappointed. And I wonder if they will restore all of those as well.
No, they weren't supposed to be there. They were there once it turned into sort of a museum kind of thing. But basically, we will be removing them. They were not there during the mission. Therefore, it is not a historic room configuration.
Is that true? I thought those signs were there. Okay.
No.
That's interesting. Because I couldn't find my way to the Capcom. One of my bucket list things was to sit in the Capcom chair, but I couldn't find it, and I didn't know exactly where it would have been. And then
You will never not. I can't even sit in a chair anymore. We're locking the place up.
Well, that's a good idea to restore it, and it is a historic monument now. That's how they call it, at least back then when I was there 12 years ago.
Yeah.
Now the two fun questions for you. Can you tell us about your wife's traditions of preparing a vest for your missions?
Yes, basically I made flight leader over in Korea. I had three young guys that just came out of fighter weapons school, and basically my job was to keep them alive and accomplish the mission. My wife would make scarves for me. If you take a look at all fighter pilot stories, they always got the scarf as a sacred entity. And basically, so I had my wife make scarves for all the people that were in my flight. When it came time as a flight director, my wife knew that my team color was white. And basically, every boss that I'd worked for before used symbols. For instance, I was at the Myrtle Beach with the 354th Gabreski, and he always drove a white Jeep so everybody would know where he was. And he did this as he drove around the base. He'd be at the mess hall. He'd be down in the dock with the people that were working out the pay, people in operations, et cetera. So it's always, word got around that Gabreski cared for his troops. Same thing, my boss out in the flight test, Ralph Saylor, basically had an Aussie hat right on the line. It reminded me of High Noon, basically going down the battle of the OK Corral kind of thing. So each one of the bosses I had, Harry Carroll, another boss in flight test, basically was red and white suspenders and red and white bow tie. So each one of these people had some marker that identified them and the people that were working for them as unique. So my wife came up with the idea. And we feel over the years, she made somewhere between 40 and 40 vests. They'd always be a white color with a couple exceptions. And they'd be different fabrics and different patterns. So by the time that they had finished the last flight in Apollo 17, we had a bunch of vests. And some of them went to Girl Scout raffles. And you could get maybe $5 or $10 for this thing. But about 5 years before the movie came out, I had a closet full of about 15 to 20 vests that I didn't know what to do with. So I threw them in the rag bag down at the place down where all the, I want to say not the rag, at the rag bag, but it's at the thrift shop for the people. And That turned into be a sad day, because when the movie came about, we had to send a vest out to Hollywood, but it had to be appraised for insurance purposes before it was set. And it was appraised at $15,000.
Wow.
And that's a good number, because I sold a couple of them from our church building fund. I had three of them. I got one up at the Smithsonian, the Apollo 13. I got another one at the George Bush Library. I got one at Space Center Houston. And I have three left right now that I haven't decided what I'm going to do with.
So Hollywood actually made a replica rather than Ed Harris wearing one of yours.
Yes, they did. Now, the thing that's interesting is that a couple of vests I saved are the one at Space Center Houston is probably the toughest one to make, because it was a metallic fabric.
Mm.
It's red, white, and blue. It's like very thin sheets of aluminum foil that had that coloration, and it was hard to maintain so it wouldn't get all pulled apart and all that. That's on display at the Space Center Houston. I got one that was made out, when I come back from Korea, I brought the wife a silk robe, a gold and silver brocade, and Gemini 9, she cut the bottom foot off to make a celebration vest. It was the first of the celebration vests for the team, and I had four of those, where the team basically pulled something out of the fire and pulled off a miracle and kept the program on track. Basically, the vest story is they did it very well in the movie Apollo 13.
Well, that's good. It was a nice tribute, and I'm sure she appreciated that. That's really cool. Let's see. Okay, I'm up to the last question, but I'm going to sneak another one into you. What do you think of that Soyuz event this morning when the booster failed on the way up for the astronaut and the cosmonaut on the way to the International Space Station? I don't know. I'm sure you've heard about that.
Yeah, I'm sure that I've heard about it, but that's about it. I only saw what happened, and it's going to be interesting to see if NASA can get a good story out of the Russians.
Well, that's
what happened and why it happened. They aren't very, very open-mouthed in that thing.
They're not forthcoming, right? The Mission Control Center that we have, which is basically a black box in a building, they can pick and choose what they want to reveal. But for the most part, from what I have seen since 1967, the Soyuz spacecraft with their boosters have been extremely reliable. Thankfully, nothing bad happened, except for the fact that the two-person crew is not going to get up to the ISS to augment the crew that they have now. But thankfully, they made it back.
Whatever the payload was for that is lost, too.
True. They probably had some supplies and such. It's not a large spacecraft by any means, but it caught me by surprise.
I don't know. I think it's going to take a while to figure out what happened and what we really heard from that.
Well, Gene, this has been a lot of fun. I've saved the most important question for last, and I ask this of all of our guests. And it always, they always think, oh, how do you go to the bathroom in space? No, I'm better than that. What's your favorite food? And what do you want for Christmas?
that's interesting. My favorite meal is ham and sweet potatoes. My favorite food is almost always a cereal. Basically, I want something that's going to provide the energy early in the day. So basically, I'll get some corn flakes. Basically, I'll get some, grape nuts flakes. They're my favorite. And basically, I go for that. What was the second question?
What do you want for Christmas?
Oh, I don't know. I don't really need anything. I just want some good health.
For your benefit, do you have any books that you've written or agendas that you'd like to tell anybody about before we sign off?
Yeah, basically the first book was turned out to be pretty good. There's a story in this one. Basically, I did a fundraiser for the PBS on the documentary I did To the Edge and Back, and they got money, and we got down to Washington, and a lot of the guys that used to work with me retired there. So we started telling war stories and really messed up their fundraising. But there was a literary agent there by the name of George Greenfield. He heard this, and he said, that guy ought to write a book. And basically, he was on my case for many months until finally he came down here and said, you are going to write a book. Well, I thought, you always want to do something like that, because I'm very proud of our people and the way and the things we did. So he got after me, and basically I sat down and started telling the story of Mission Control and the teams. It's called A Failure is Not an Option. It was published in 2000. The History Channel took the book and basically turned it into a documentary of the same title. And basically it made New York Times bestseller, which is pretty cool. But basically it covers the early space program up through the end of Apollo. It was really a blast. I was not computer literate at the time I did this. I used a Brothers word processor with floppy disks. And the publisher wanted to use Apple, and they wanted to use internet data transfer. So in one day, I bought my first computer, signed on the internet, and went downhill from there.
Good story, Gene. Listen, I can't thank you enough. Our listeners, I'm sure, appreciated hearing all of your stories and history and everything. Well worth the wait, because I know you're an extremely busy gentleman with a schedule that's got to be crazy, because everybody wants to talk to you, and I really appreciate you sharing some time with us. And from Sun Sounds of Arizona, Godspeed. From the Air Force, aim high.
Okay, you got it. Have a good one.
All right, bye. You too. An interview with legendary flight director from NASA, Gene Kranz. This is Rich Kirshner reporting.
You're listening to The Space Program.
And now, let's take a trip back to 1969.
Houston, Texas. The upcoming moon landing mission of Apollo 12. Comments by the flight director from Apollo Mission Control. That's the story, the highlights in a moment, as NASA presents the space story.
The Space Story, a weekly space and aeronautics report brought to you by this station and NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration.
Apollo 12, the country's second manned moon landing mission. The astronauts assigned the task of picking up where their historic Apollo 11 predecessors left off will be spacecraft commander Charles Pete Conrad, command module pilot Richard Gordon, and lunar module pilot Alan Bean. While Gordon monitors their activities from lunar orbit, Conrad and Bean are slated to maneuver their landing craft to a soft touchdown in the moon's ocean of storms, hopefully within walking distance of the Surveyor 3 spacecraft, which was landed on the lunar surface by remote control in 1967.
On Apollo 12, as during previous flights, direction of the mission after launch will be from NASA's Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas. There, inside the Apollo Mission Control Center, Prime Flight Director Jerry Griffin will lead four teams of ground controllers.
The Apollo 12 flight plan is very similar to the Apollo 11 flight plan in many ways. We will be staying on Apollo 12 on the lunar surface for approximately 32 hours. On Apollo 11, we stayed only 20. Also, while we are on the surface, we will conduct two extravehicular activities, which will necessitate the crew coming back into the LEM spacecraft and recharging the portable life support systems, or the backpacks.
For astronauts Conrad and Bean, work outside their landing craft will involve deployment of several sophisticated scientific experiments which will be left behind to operate on the surface. Photographs will be taken, rock and soil samples gathered, and during the second extravehicular activity, the men are to venture some distance away from the lunar module, over to examine the now silent Surveyor spacecraft if it's nearby. Flight Director Jerry Griffin explained that the major reason for attempting to touch down near the Surveyor vehicle is to help perfect man's ability to make pinpoint landings on pre-selected lunar areas.
So that for later missions we can carry on a very detailed exploration of the lunar surface. Now on Apollo 12, if we land next to Surveyor, close enough to it for the astronauts to reach it, we feel that it'll be a free bonus dividend in that we will be able to see a piece of gear that's on the surface, has been on the surface there now for over 2 years, and we can possibly pull off some samples and return them to Earth. We can also examine the lunar soil around the Surveyor and see how it has held up to meteorite bombardment, etc., since it has been initially disturbed.
We asked Prime Flight Director Jerry Griffin to briefly outline major milestones for the entire upcoming Apollo 12 mission in comparison to last July's Apollo 11 flight.
Apollo 12 will lift off from Cape Kennedy on pad 39A. We will go into Earth orbit, check the systems out, and if we're go, we will restart the S-4B and burn on to the translunar trajectory. We will break into lunar orbit, much the same as we have on the other lunar missions. The timeline in lunar orbit will be much the same. We will descend and land, stay on the lunar surface this mission for 32 hours, which is a little longer than Apollo 11. Then we will pull off the ascent and rendezvous and stay in lunar orbit approximately one more day after that, take pictures of some future landing sites for some later Apollo missions. Then we will conduct TEI, trans-Earth injection, just as we have on the past missions, and return to the mid-Pacific, and the total mission duration will be about 245 hours, 5 hours over 10 days.
Comments on the upcoming moon landing mission by Apollo 12 Prime Flight Director Jerry Griffin. The story from NASA's Manned Spacecraft Center, Houston, Texas. This has been the Space Story, a weekly space and aeronautics report, brought to you by this station and NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Kennedy Ludlam with Willard Scott reporting.
From the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, and God bless all of you on the good Earth.
This has been The Space Program, NASA's past, present, and future. We'll be right back.